This is The Guardian.
Today, the government has passed its landmark social care reforms. But who is picking up the bill? Last week, a few days after the Prime Minister made a major announcement about how the government will fund changes to social care.
This will raise almost £36 billion over the next 3 years, with money from the levy going directly to health and social care across the whole of our United Kingdom.
I went to meet Leslie.
Hi, is it Leslie?
Yes.
Is it all right if I come in?
Yes.
To talk about the challenges she faced in getting the support she needed for her mother.
Mum, Bloomer Samuels, is 90. She was a hairdresser by profession. She's really camp. She's really funny. She's kind of a local heroine. You kind of couldn't go shopping with Mum in North London without being stopped by somebody who she would have done their hair or she would have worked with them in a salon. So she's a really vibrant character.
My first thought when I look at that face, she's incredibly glamorous.
She's really glamorous. She's still glamorous. She's the absolute talk of the care home. She's really elegant. She still trims her own hair in the care home. Don't get me started.
Why should I not get you started on that?
She's still got her hairdressing scissors in the care home.
Bloomer has Parkinson's, osteoporosis, and a number of other health conditions. And while this means she has needs which are particular to her, the story of how she and Leslie struggled to access care will be familiar to millions across the country. In short, it's very complicated and incredibly expensive.
She is incredible. She just has a will to stay here. She says, I don't want to die. I'm too nosy.
Oh, that's amazing. That's a bit how I feel, yeah. She's still got that inquisitiveness and that interest in life and in people.
Yeah.
Now, after decades of politicians promising to fix social care, Boris Johnson has announced a plan which he says will do just that. Last night, MPs voted it through Parliament, despite concerns that this will punish some of the lowest earners in the country, whilst doing very little to actually change the system for people like Bloomer. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, has the government found a way out of the social care crisis? Leslie, you've told me about your mother, Bloomer, who lives in a care home in North London. When did you first realise she was going to start needing to pay some money towards care or some extra support in her life?
At the end of 2016, she wasn't very well. She had stomach problems. So that was the end of 2016. And then at the beginning of 2017, she was diagnosed with bowel cancer. So she had surgery in the March. And then we were told that she should have chemotherapy. And then by September, I realised that she needed much, much more assistance. So I would have to go around more. There would be lots of incidents of her not being able to get out of bed. Her GP was involved by this stage. She was really worried about her. I, by now, was completely running her home. So I was doing all of her shopping, definitely on top of all of her medication. And then by the end of 2017, I just had the worst Christmas with her ever. She had false Christmas Day, Boxing Day, New Year's Day. And the thing with medication for any conditions is you have to take the pills regularly. And with Parkinson's, you shake. So just dealing with like blister packs of medication is really, really difficult. With the legendary nails that she wouldn't cut, you know, even more impossible. And if you don't have the medication, you don't have the mobility. And it just began to go really, really pear-shaped.
How was this affecting her at the time? I mean, did you see her change during this period?
Yeah, massively. Confusion, hallucinations. The worst thing for Parkinson's is isolation. That's absolutely the worst thing because you lose all sense of day and night. She would make meals for people who weren't there. She would get medication out for people who weren't there. So it was scary. And it was at that point, August 2018, and I just said, Mum, you can't be in this flat on your own anymore. And then I just didn't know what to do. So the first port of call was her GP. And then I was assigned a social worker, but we had to wait weeks and weeks for somebody to come round for these initial interviews. The outcome of that assessment was that she didn't need full-time care.
Why do you think that was? Why do you think they came to that decision? Because what you're seeing and what they were saying seemed like completely different things.
Why they came to that decision is because there's only a certain amount of money to go round. So Mum's danger, Mum's criteria didn't meet the financial support because there would be people far worse off than her who did need the support. So Mum goes to the back of the queue.
Which meant that you then had to consider putting her in a private care home. How much was that going to cost you when you started looking into it?
So I already knew that it was going to cost at least £1,000 a week, if not more, for her to go into full-time care.
How did you work out how you were going to pay, how you and your mother were going to pay for her care?
There was absolutely no alternative but to sell her home.
And when she moved into the home, you know, at the beginning, if you think back to those sort of early few months, were you impressed? I mean, was she happy there?
She was happy. She was safe. She was thriving. And I, at last, had peace of mind. Yes, you still got the phone calls if she had a fall, if she wasn't well. But I knew essentially she was being looked after really well 24/7. And you can't put a price on that.
Torsten Bell, you are the director of the Resolution Foundation, which is a think tank that focuses on economic and social policy. You know a lot about funding social care. Let's start with the basics. What do we actually mean when we say social care?
Well, here we're talking about the support for people who have ongoing health needs, whether that's in their home, getting up and making sure they're getting their food or personal care, or in a residential home. And crucially, it's the kind of personal care that isn't covered by the National Health Service. So it's not the care, you know, you need when you get cancer, when you get a significant disease. It's specifically to do with personal care when you have other needs that mean you need support.
Let's talk about how social care is paid for now before any of the government's changes kick in next April. Social care is funded differently across the nations of the UK, and Leslie lives in England. She had to make the difficult decision to sell her mother's home to pay for her care. Is that typical?
What is typical is that at the point at which people either themselves or their family need very significant amount of social care, it's often a shock that that doesn't come free or indeed even heavily subsidised in lots of cases, because we're all used to the NHS and we're used to it during our lives, and most of us don't spend lots of time thinking in advance about what will happen if we get sick in our later life or we develop very serious care needs because of an accident or anything else. So when it does happen, it's a shock, one, because bad things are happening to us, and two, because a system we haven't thought about very much doesn't offer much by way of support. And that's because if you have any significant assets, then you will be means tested out of the state support system.
And when you say significant assets, you mean more than £23,250. Go over that and you have to start paying for your care. And there is no cap on costs, which is why people like Leslie's mother have to sell their homes. But when people are being assessed, are their houses included in that calculation?
So there's a bit, it's really important difference between whether you are receiving domiciliary care, so care in your own home. If that's happening, then the value of your home won't be included in the asset test to decide whether you get state support or you have to pay yourself for your care. But if you move into a residential home and you haven't got, for example, a partner living in your home, that house will count against the asset test and you will have to contribute.
Right, so it's quite a complicated system with a significant amount of people paying for themselves. But you've also got local authorities funding a lot of social care in this country on tightening budgets. What does this mean for the quality of care that's available.
So we're seeing two big effects. One is the rationing of care, where local authorities raise the bar about how serious your needs need to be before you get some social care. And then we're also seeing pressure within the system on how that care is provided, the quality of it. You will have all seen news stories growing over the course of, you know, actually a number of years about 15-minute visits. You'll also have heard stories about social care workforce being pretty badly paid given how hard the job is, you know, huge numbers of them earning below the living wage. And if you talk to any social care provider, they'll tell you stories about very fast turnover of staff. And that all reflects the same underlying cause, which is an underfunding of a system that's facing very serious pressures to do more.
This is a crisis that has been building for many years. Why have successive governments failed to do anything about it?
Because it is very hard, because it is very expensive, and because the longer we have left it, the harder it has got. And so every time another set of politicians has come round to the problem, the bill they face to try and deal with it has been higher. Every prime minister, you know, at least since the 2000s, has promised to deal with this social care problem because it's been growing over that period as our population ageing has sped up. The most extreme examples are Gordon Brown proposing a higher, you know, sharing of social care costs, with some people inside the then Labour government proposing doing that via a form of inheritance taxation. That was the death tax that some of your listeners will remember from the posters from the Conservative Party at the time. But yeah, and that's one of the reasons that put off the Conservative government in the early part of the last decade trying to do anything about social care. It just wasn't a big enough political priority to be worth facing the political risks of somebody else putting up a similar poster about you. Theresa May tried to answer it by asking those who did need social care and did have significant assets to contribute slightly more towards it. And she got, you know, branded as offering a dementia tax, as did Gordon Brown and Andy Burnham back in the previous decade. So the politics combining with difficult trade-offs, where there are some big losers as well as really important but quite concentrated winners, is a hard political problem to crack.
In Boris Johnson's first speech as Prime Minister in July 2019, he promised that his government would fix the crisis in social care once and for all with a clear plan.
To give every older person the dignity and security they deserve.
That plan only materialised in Parliament last week.
We will create a new UK-wide 1.25% health and social care levy on earned income hypothecated in law.
What did he announce?
Well, in big picture terms, what the Prime Minister has announced is that he'd like to put up taxes, particularly on the earnings of the working age population, to do a better job of sharing the costs of social care for those who are unlucky enough to need it if they have significant assets. And those are the people at the moment that can face very high costs if they're unlucky enough to need social care. And the Prime Minister is socialising more of those costs, the state bearing more of those costs in future than it has in the past.
What this means is that from next April, the amount you spend on social care will be capped at £86,000. After that, local authorities will foot the bill, and people with assets between £20,000 and £100,000 will be means tested for council support. How much are these changes going to cost all of us?
What we're seeing is a £14 billion tax rise, which when you know, get into how the money's doled out, translates into about a £10 billion a year extra spent on health and care priorities overall. Actually, only about 20% of this goes on social care in the short term. More of it goes into the NHS or goes into other Department for Health priorities like testing as the pandemic rolls on into next year. But the money that is going into social care, probably something in the order of £3 billion, by 2023-24, so not insignificant, but not the majority of the extra spending that's been announced. And that is being used to make the means test that determines how much you have to contribute towards your care if you do have some assets, to make that significantly more generous. So now, if you have assets even just a little bit over £20,000, you'll have to pay everything towards your own social care. Whereas when this policy kicks in, that will rise to £100,000 before the state pays nothing towards your care. So this is a really big, big improvement.
So if an individual, say, earns at the moment, I don't know, 30K a year, how much roughly will they have to spend additionally now with this increase?
Visibly, they will notice they're paying something in the region of £200 a year, more slightly above that. But half of national insurance is obviously also paid by employer. So we're putting up here both employee, which you see on your payslip, and employer national insurance, which your employer pays, as it says on the tin. In the end, that employer contribution will probably translate into lower wages, because in the end, the employer will want to recoup the money from somewhere. So the actual cost for the employee will be more significant than that in the longer term. But up front, we're talking, you know, a bit over £200.
So this is going to be a hard sell for a lot of people. I mean, I'm thinking, for example, if you are someone who has recently graduated and is in a first job earning in the low 20,000s with a mountain of student debt to pay off, how are the government going to persuade someone in that situation that, you know, this is a good idea?
That is part of the backlash you're seeing against the national insurance rise as it's been designed. So someone who's in their mid-20s today and is doing a kind of pretty normal job, they probably will be asking why those pensioners who are going to be big beneficiaries of these policy, remember, you know, this is the pension cohort that's higher income than previous pensioner cohorts and also has much higher assets. And it's those assets that this change to the means test is protecting. So the 25-year-old will probably ask why we're not more fairly asking that older generation to contribute towards the costs of this important policy progress. And I think that's a reasonable question for them to be asking.
And while this is being talked about as an increase in national insurance, is this effectively just a whole new tax in itself?
The fact that there will be something on your payslip called the health and care levy, I think, is a sensible thing to do in terms of the politics of this. It makes almost no difference to either the economics at the personal finance level or indeed to the public finances. This is just another general increase in national insurance. And national insurance itself is also dressed up as being different, but it's basically just a poorly designed version of income tax that only applies to some kinds of income. And that is, in the end, the big problem with the national insurance rise, which is that the unfairness in national insurance isn't that it's worse for rich than poor. It's that it's very unfair between different kinds of income. If you get your money from a pension, you pay nothing. If you get it from going out to work, you pay a lot. If you get your money because you're a landlord and you take it as tenant's income, you don't pay anything towards this levy. But if you're a working tenant in that very same property paying that rent, you will be asked to pay.
The big promise that Boris Johnson made in that 2019 speech was that people wouldn't have to sell their homes to pay for their care, like Leslie had to do for her mother.
My job is to protect you or your parents or grandparents from the fear of having to sell your home to pay for the costs of care.
Does this plan mean he keeps that promise?
Lots of people will still, in the end, need to use the value of their homes to contribute towards their care. Think of, for example, of someone who's goes into residential care and faces very significant costs. Even if those costs are capped to £86,000, if they have a property worth, say, £200,000, and they don't have £86,000 worth of other assets, so cash or shares or things they can sell, then they will have to use that property to pay towards their social care costs until they hit that £86,000 cap.
Is that in their lifetime or after they die?
So that's an important point. In most cases, what will happen is that the local authority will put a charge on the house but not actually sell it. And then when they die in the estate, if the estate sells the property, then the local authority will get its money back at that point. So you won't need to sell. No one will be forced to sell their house. And that's true now during their lifetime, although some choose to do so. This is done via a charge by the local authority.
Most of the money raised from this national insurance rise will go towards the NHS, which I think most people will be happy with after the last year and a half.
The sharp rise in waiting time shows the heavy toll that the pandemic has had on the NHS. Almost all non-urgent surgery, like hip and knee replacements, was stopped in March to make more space for coronavirus patients.
But will it actually help to reduce the huge backlog that we hear about, which is stopping people often getting really urgent care?
In terms of how that actually plays out, I think that is quite hard to know, because part of this depends on the path of the pandemic in the coming months and years, about how big the ongoing pressures are of COVID. I mean, most people's view of those who are know much more about this than I do is that we should expect the waiting list for care to actually be rising further in the coming months. And then the hope is that we then start to turn that tide as we move into future years. And that's why, you know, if you look at what the health secretary said.
In the first 3 years, the majority of these new funds that are being raised will go into the NHS and helping it, as you say, with that backlog. And I think most people can see why that would be the case.
He's talking about 3 years, hopefully, to see the backlog fall. I mean, you know, the consensus view of people who are, again, as I say, more expert than I am, is that that might be possible, but it's probably on the optimistic end.
Coming up, Leslie on the big problem in social care that a rise in national insurance payments won't be able to fix.
Leslie, what did you think when you heard the news last week about the government's social care announcement? I mean, are you pleased that this is something that is being addressed?
I just think the whole pandemic has shone such a light on how desperate social care really is. Something had to be announced. And I think, you know, the government have been shamed into announcing something. But talking in telephone numbers and saying this amount of money is going to be allocated to this and that amount's going to be allocated to that is not going to solve the fundamental problems in social care.
How has this announcement, which is making us all think about social care in a way because we're all implicated through the rise in national insurance, how has this and how has caring for your mother made you think about saving for your own old age and for what will happen to you later in life?
It's kind of something that you don't want to think about, but I just think, well, you know, what do I do? I haven't got a tiger daughter who's going to look after me in the way that I've looked after my mum and made sure the best thing happens for her. You know, it does make you really terrified. What's going to happen to me? I live on my own now. What's going to happen to me? You know, even in this current situation, what if I had an accident and I needed to go into respite care? Would I get it? I don't think anybody minds paying for future care if the money is really going to be allocated to the care, but it's unclear where the money's going. My mum's paid national insurance and tax. I've been paying, you know, the top whack of national insurance. So I would like to think I was paying for my mum's future care, which she now has had to sell her home to pay for her care.
It's been an incredibly difficult 18 months for anyone who is in a care home or for friends and relatives of someone in a care home. How is Bloomer now at this point in the pandemic?
She's a complete shadow of her former self. The pandemic has completely and utterly ravaged her, mostly because of a year's separation from me. Sorry.
That's all right. Take a moment.
Which was just a complete, it was just unthinkable, and nobody knew how long it was going to go on for. I stood outside her window for a year, basically.
What do you think your experience of trying to care for your mother during this pandemic has told you about what we as a country need to do to fix social care?
There needs to be more joined up writing for a start. And if somebody doesn't have a family member to be their representative, they need a representative who knows absolutely everything about all of their conditions and what they need. The pandemic has just shown us that you can't shut old people up and banish them from their family. It is brutal. It is cruel and it is still going on.
Torsten, you can hear from Leslie that she doesn't think this announcement goes far enough. And a lot of Conservative politicians are also unhappy about it because it breaks a promise in their manifesto not to raise taxes. When he spoke last week, Boris Johnson defended doing so by saying,
"Yes, I accept that this breaks a manifesto commitment, which is not something I do lightly, but a global pandemic was in no one's manifesto, Mr. Speaker."
Is COVID the sole reason that the government are deciding to pay for social care in this way?
I think what is true, and Boris is obviously being flippant, but is right that there wasn't a pandemic in anyone's manifesto. What is true is that the difficulty of doing something about social care and vaguely decently funding the NHS without very large tax rises has been made materially more difficult by the impact of the pandemic. That's partly because obviously it's made our economy smaller than it otherwise would have been. But it's also obviously because there's direct pressures on the social care and the health system and the NHS backlogs we're discussing that means that the costs of just doing what we thought we were going to be doing anyway have gone up.
What has the Labour Party come up with in response to this? And where does this really leave them in terms of what they can propose?
So, I mean, the Labour Party so far has focused on noting that the social care package doesn't deal with all the problems in the social care system, which I think is true and fair.
The quality of care received will not improve. There's no plan for that. People will still go without the care that they need. There's no plan for that. Unpaid family carers will still be pushed to breaking point. There's no plan for that.
What they haven't said is exactly what their answer is. The sounds are that it's something that looks more like an income tax rise, maybe with some wealth tax elements alongside it, but I have no idea whether they intend to set an actual concrete policy out anytime soon.
There's no doubt then, Torsten, that this problem of social care is enormous and, as you say, it's growing. Now Boris Johnson has presented his plan to try and fix it. But do you think in 10 years' time, we'll look back on this as the moment that the government actually managed to achieve that?
I think we'll look back on this moment and it will mark a significant change in how much the state is seen as being in the business of paying for people's social care. Because although the cap has been set at a relatively high level of £86,000, what we've done is to get seriously into the business of protecting more of people's assets. And once that happens, it will become a more normal part of day-to-day politics. I have to say, what it's not going to do is be the moment when we look back and say that the broader spending pressures on the sector were addressed and we entered a new kind of golden era for social care, because that's definitely not where we are.
Torsten, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Torsten Bell from the Resolution Foundation. He regularly writes for The Guardian. Find his work at the website. Thanks to Leslie for speaking to me. Tomorrow, along with hundreds of people, she will be protesting in Westminster as part of the Rights for Residents campaign, which wants care home visiting rights enshrined in law. You can read more about it at theguardian.com in an article written by Rob Booth about a 100-year-old woman called Frances who last week made a video plea calling for greater freedoms for her and others like her living in care homes. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Archie Bland. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.